financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vaunting. You're listening to the Vaunting Podcast.
And welcome to the Vaunu Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. Today is no different. I'm Kyle and...
I'm Shane. And since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, the Vaunu Podcast is covered by BIPCOT's No Government License. Reuse and modification is permitted to anyone, except for governments and the agents thereof. You can learn more at BIPCOT.org.
So, Shane, how's life been living under the boot of the communist state of Illinois thus far?
Well, it's always been pretty terrible, obviously. But, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. I actually, you know, just found out today that I'll be heading down to southern Illinois this weekend. So, you know, all of the terrible things, like all of the terrible aspects about being here, you know, are going to disappear for a few days. So I can go to my utopia, I guess you could call it. Although it's a real place, so it's not actually utopia, right? So, you know, yeah, you know, things are looking up now. I'll get to get out of this hellhole for a few days. So, you know, really looking forward to that.
Well, that's definitely good to hear. Let's see, on my end, actually kind of two things that kind of cropped up. One is, in considering our previous episode on van nomadism, apparently my car got kind of hit with like a $350 repair on the engine. And, you know, thankfully I don't have to be at work for the next couple days because I have flex scheduling or whatever it is. And so, yeah, there are days where I'm working 10 hours a day and other days where I'm just at home. But I just kind of was thinking, like, did Rayo ever do like his own repairs on his van, or did he like have to like hire somebody to fix it? Because that's something that never came up in the book.
I don't think he ever specified. I don't think he ever specified. That's a good point. I don't know. I would imagine, you know, if I had to posit a guess, I would think that he probably did, you know, most of the maintenance. He was definitely kind of that engineering, you know, kind of technical type of person. And just from, you know, transcribing from Vaunting Life March 1973, his two, there was one section on how to build and design with natural timbers, and there was also warmth without fire, complete plans for a $55 foam hut. And they were very technical articles. So I think, you know, Rayo, being a formidable person that he was, I think he probably could have handled basic maintenance at least, if not more than that.
Yeah, and so maybe that's a potential season 3 episode, more about like carb maintenance or whatever. Because of course, if you get stranded at the side of the road, whether or not you're doing the van nomadism thing or not, if you get stranded at the side of the road, you are more vulnerable to coercion than you were before, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. And if you can't fix it and you have to just sit there and wait, even more so. So I would imagine, you know, just kind of going off that alone, I think, you know, Rayo probably could handle, you know, most things that could possibly go wrong. But, you know, that's just a guess. I don't think he'd want to put himself in a position where, you know, he had to rely upon somebody else, because that's not the type of person he was. So if something happened, he wanted to be the one to fix it, is kind of the way that I kind of understand him from I guess, or looking at it from like 40 years later. Yeah.
something like that. And something else too. I think there was that couple episodes ago where he mentioned about buying private land, and then there was kind of the segue on like allodial title and a couple other things. It's interesting, you know. I was reading a book about I think it's literally called Buying Rural Land in Texas by some sort of scholar whose name I honestly don't remember. And it was interesting. He very much poo-poos the idea of like buying land as like something to pass on to your heirs. But he views private land ownership only as a vehicle to like making profit, whether in the context of land speculation or, as was he was mainly pushing for, really agricultural, you know, like farming profits and such. And so in terms of trying to be invulnerable to coercion, in terms of like in some cases even hiding, I'm now starting to even more appreciate Rayo's skepticism regarding private land ownership, because even this more mainstream book was saying, and specifically in here in Texas, how owning land privately in Texas may not be all that it's chalked up to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, there is something to be said, you know, like with our land in Southern Illinois. My dad bought, you know, that first piece when he was in high school. And I think we bought his initially, you know, 20, 30, 40 acres. You know, he paid cash for that. And it was like 700. Like, I remember it was very, very cheap when he purchased the land, like maybe $750 an acre or something like that. Cheap. And, you know, by the time he sold it, I think it was worth $2,000 or $3,000. You know, and that'd be 25 years later thereabouts. So there's something to be said. If you're going to hold on to it for a long time, you know, maybe there'd be that profit, I guess, that profit opportunity available there. But, you know, I certainly understand Rayo's arguments, and also the one that guy made in the book that you're referring to about how, you know, land speculation, just kind of, you know, holding on to it for profit is a good avenue. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's yeah. So obviously, folks, I've been kind of doing some advanced research for season 3 episodes. And yeah, there's some details and sometimes even nuance and minutiae that makes life very interesting, at least in some sense or another. So again, kind of like how Rayo mentioned about like how Vanu is not an all or nothing thing. There very much is a spectrum in sorts. Shades of Gray, at least in some sense, then, yeah, I'm really now seeing it now that, you know, getting to the actual direct action, more specific methods of Vanu and all that, yes, there's a lot of options. That's true. But then again, you have to tailor it to yourself. You know, it has to be tailored to specific individuals, because, you know, not all solutions, quote unquote, not all solutions work equally for everyone. Right. What may well work for you may not work well for the man standing next to you, and so forth.
Right. And I guess one of the notes, it might be a good idea to forward the title of that book on to Derek Bros for when they you know, start their intentional community, because they're gonna have to purchase, you know, private land when they do that. So I don't know. Yeah, if you send me a link to that, I'll just forward it on to him, because he was actually the one. I don't know if I mentioned this on the last episode, but he was actually the one that sent me the Vanu Life March 1973. So I don't know what he was looking for. I think he's intrigued now, but that's good. But yeah, you know, I might be valuable to him as well. So, you know, after the show, I'll get that from you and you know, I'll forward it on to him.
Sure, of course. And obviously, I haven't finished reading that book yet, so I'm not 100% on whether I think the author is off base or not. But I'm pretty much a couple chapters in, and there's a consistent pattern of and it's not even the words he's using; it's the tone of the book. Where basically, if you're not making financial profit from the land, you're basically an idiot for taking on all this risk, like in the form of property taxes and so forth. It's kind of like where he's coming from. And that's another thing too. He said, actually, this is rather important. There's also a recurring theme of people who are emotionally attached to land are idiots, because they're essentially kind of setting the preconditions for their own financial, you know, bankruptcy.
I'm an idiot then.
As opposed to dispassionate investors, whether in the form of speculation or agricultural development and so forth, who are going to be quote unquote successful, but really what he meant is making bank on off of land ownership. He was even one more step and said even people who buy rural land and then develop it turn into a freaking shopping mall are smart, successful people. So this book is very mainstream. However, what's good about it tentatively is that it's focusing on, as the title goes, buying rural land in Texas. So it's location to this part of America with a K, and it's more about rural land. So in terms of like private land ownership that you may want to consider hiding your van on or whatever else, or as is the case with this particular episode on a Vanu shelter. The private land ownership that we've covered on that previous episode. Yeah, Rayo's skepticism, I think, is well founded, because this very mainstream book I'm reading on land here in Texas is I don't know the right adjective. I would say cynical, but I don't think that quite does it justice. It's very it's very shrewd. There we go. That's the right word. It's a very shrewd way of looking at land ownership. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. And the worst part is that in some sense, he's probably right, because he was also mentioning legal issues when somebody dies and they try to pass the land on to their children. The fact that the children usually, more often than not, in terms of our experience in dealing with these legal matters, is that the children pretty much like bicker with each other for like 6 months to a year or more, trying to come up with an equitable settlement. And sometimes it even goes to court, the government courts. Oh, there you go. The government courts who then kind of impose a ruling, basically selling it far below market value. So then everybody loses out. So like there's some more stuff going on there in terms of just land ownership here in Texas. But again, we'll see if we can say that maybe for a season 3 episode possibly.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting subject to cover in season 3 as we kind of develop beyond that. Luckily, I don't think I'll have to run into any of those issues. At least feuding with my brother, we get along pretty well. At least as of now, things change, right? Hopefully that stays I don't see any reason why that would change. But sounds like an interesting book, and sounds like he's at least in line with Ray on at least that one aspect.
Yeah, so far would seem to be the case. So, ladies and gentlemen, this episode is entitled Vanu Shelters, Invulnerable Home Bases. And the show notes can be found at vanupodcast.com/25. So is there anything you'd like to mention before we go on, Shane?
I guess just one thing real briefly. As we've covered, Rayo's baby, when it came to strategies was kind of the Van Nomadism. That was his primary and his first, Vanu home base, his Vanu shelter was that van. And obviously they moved into the polyethylene A tent, kind of splitting time between that and the van. So those were, Rayo's two forms of Vanu shelter, Vanu home bases, and those terms will be used synonymously. But also keep in mind that the last couple of episodes we've done on, van nomadism and minimalist sailboating, those also could be, Vanu home bases and Vanu shelters. So, Vanu home bases can either be temporary autonomous zones or permanent autonomous zones. Obviously, more issues to be dealt with, when it comes to the passes, but yeah, that's all I've got.
Yeah, so essentially whether the shelter is mobile like the sailboat or a van or something else, or it's more stationary, the point is that Vanu shelters come in all shapes and sizes, at least to some extent, right? The main thing being it has to facilitate invulnerability to coercion, which I think will be a good segue to our definitions. So Shane, since you're the definition man this go around, what is a Vanu shelter, aka Vanu home base?
Yeah, so a Vanu shelter or a Vanu home base, again using those synonymously, is a hardened home that serves as a base of activity. Such a structure is where a Vanuan is to be the most invulnerable to coercion, and that last part is the most important. The Vanu home base is where you're going to be most invulnerable to coercion. And Ray will explain why momentarily, but also important here is mentioning import-export, which obviously will be, I think it's valuable to redefine import-export and one-directional isolationism because they're so crucial to the Vanu home bases. I mean, that's like kind of that's one part of the equation. So obviously import-export, is obviously very important when it comes to Vanu home bases as well.
All right, so let's revisit that again. And obviously, for folks who want more details on this beyond just the definitions here, please go to our season 1 episode on, I think it was the Servile Society, where we really kind of really lay down the law, so to speak, on import-export. But yes, just as a quick refresher, Shane, what is import-export?
Yeah, so import-export concisely explains how Vanuans, those who have an invulnerability to coercion, how they relate to the servile society. So this is obviously extremely important because, as I've said in previous episodes, there's always going to be a state of servile society. That's just kind of my outlook, and it's not good, it's not bad, it's just kind of neutral. It's a recognition, recognition of that fact. So obviously, it's pretty important to understand how Vanuans do relate to that society, and how that trade is conducted. That's basically it.
Right, and this is all. And import export is also further explicated by our next defined and revisiting this again. One directional isolationism. So what is that?
Yeah. So a one directional isolation of import export is used to maintain access to the servile society's open but not free trading centers, yet denying them access to a Vanuan's home through importing goods and knowledge while exporting labor or products back out to the servile society. So it's very much, it's very much so you're importing those goods and knowledge from the servile society, and you're exporting the labor and the products back out to it. And it's very, very important that those things stay separate. It's one directional isolationism. That's pretty crucial.
Yeah, and just something to add on to that, I just thought of, is that there is no shared culture at all. Because I think there was something Rayo mentioned elsewhere about how, like, how do you exist while being fully immersed within a philosophically alien society that's hostile to your values? And so the answer to that was import, export, one directional isolationism, and so forth. At least that's what kind of Rayo thought was a way of dealing with that. So in other words, the way that Vanuans relate to the servile society at most would be more commercial in nature, because there is no shared culture. So we, if we're doing the collective movementism routine one more time, we are not one people at all, not even close. Even if there was a we, which there isn't. But we are not one people. And so therefore, since there is no culture, you know, there is no common heritage or culture, maybe a common language. But even then, the only reason for the common language is to facilitate commerce. You know, we're not like raising our kids together kind of thing. Right.
It's not because we live in America and we speak English.
Well, yeah, and of course, English as a language itself has now gone global, right? I mean, it's kind of like the old example, not to go too long on this, but just to wrap this up nicely, like, how does the, let's say, the Chinese airport controller talk to the Russian pilot? Well, the reason that the Chinese air traffic controller can talk to the Russian pilot is that both of them are speaking in English. That's actually how things run, but most people here in America with a K don't understand stuff like that. Because, again, to kind of wrap this up, it has been scientifically proven that American voters are irrational, and part of that are their biases. They have an anti-market bias, for one, but they also have an anti-foreign bias. So they automatically kind of presume that foreigners are bad, even if they claim to be, you know, multiculturally sensitive, which they're not. And that's the lie from the left. But of course, the lie from the right is then claiming they value markets, where in fact they value fascist corporatism and so forth, you know, subsidies to corporations and such, and things more along those lines, undue favors from the state. To men who claim to be industrialists, who may even claim to be entrepreneurs and self-made men, but then, of course, couldn't actually run their corporations without government subsidies, whether it's corn subsidies or whatever else. And that's, of course, without, and also the tax breaks that they get, but that you and I don't get. And so forth. So that kind of shows you the value of the special interest lobbying and all that. So considering all that and more, yeah, we are not one people, not even freaking close. And so, yeah, so there is no common really anything. And so the only reason that we use the Federal Reserve notes, or we communicate in English, has nothing to do with culture and has everything to do with commerce and people just trying to survive. It's a question of survivability, not a question of how shall we then live.
I you're exactly right. I guess just one other comment here. I guess that there is, you know, one shared, you know, when it comes to the state of the servile society and its inhabitants, there is one common bond, and that bond is, you know, the belief in the state. You know, whatever for to use whatever they want to use it for. So if there was going to be one common bond, it's not freedom, because you're here in America, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's not the language. It's the only common thing is, yeah, it's just their belief in the state, and the fact that you know, they think that you know, violence is a good way to, you know, organize society. So I guess that'd be the only commonality between, you know, not only the state of servile society here in America, but also, you know, around the world too.
And just to kind of add on to that, but in terms of like the relationship between the Vanuans and the servile society, at most would be commercial, hence import export, the one directional isolationism, because there is nothing else.
Right.
There is nothing else. And while maybe hypothetically some Vanuans might be minarchists or polyarchists, maybe, you know, even they understand that the state is evil. So, you know, and so whether they need to exorcise even more spooks from their head is kind of something they need to deal with. But whether they be of the limited government or no government persuasion or whatever, the point is that they know the state is evil. And even then, they're more kind of sensitive on like cultural issues and such. So, yeah, as far as I'm aware of, Vanuans have nothing in common with the alleged traditional cultures of conservatism, and they have even less commonality, arguably, with the alleged, or shall we say, the real cultural Marxism, right? And there's that too. So, and any flavor of authoritarian fill in the blank, whether it's a multiculturalism or whether it's a traditionalism, Vanuans really don't. There's nothing in common. There's nothing there. And the only reason to deal with those in the servile society is for purpose of survivability, because we just haven't simply built our own infrastructure yet of one kind or another. And I think Rayo even said something to that effect as well.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So let's look at what Rayo had to say regarding the Vanu shelters, because remember, the purpose of the Vanu shelters is that when we're not doing import-export and we're just strictly on, you know, I guess you could say in our second realm, away from the state, away from the servile society and so forth, away from that first realm, if you will, that so much tyranny is rampant in. When we have our own stuff, if you will, our own infrastructure, how do you go about building that? What does that look like? And I would suggest that the first or among the first of that second realm of sorts would really be these Vanu shelters, basically people's like home bases that then could develop into other things. So let's look at what Rayo said, quote, "Have savings before moving. During your first year or two in a wilderness or other Vanu environment, expect to be occupied developing shelter and learning Vanu living skills. You will have little time for money earning, even if opportunities are at hand." Close quote. I will just mention here, Shane, unless you have something else to add, that really for more information on financial independence, please see the premiere episode of season 2 on financial independence.
Right. So whenever you're beginning your journey as a Vanuan, yeah, you're gonna spend a lot of time developing shelter. If you just look at the, you know, even just a couple of articles that were in Vanu, the Search for Personal Freedom, you can tell that's what took up most of Rayo and Halen or Roberta or Naomi. Their time, it took up a lot of their time developing shelter, and that's the largest section. Yeah, the largest section for sure in Vanu Life, March 1973. So that was something that they focused on pretty heavily, even in 1973, you know, after they'd done this for almost 10 years. So over 10 years. So just a note there.
All right, quote, "Don't change vocations until you achieve a Vanu home. If you can clear $2 or more per hour in your present non-Vanu job, you'll probably achieve Vanu quickest by staying with it until you have enough capital to cut loose for 2 years," close quote. Now, again, like when I wrote my article on financial independence and I had to like correct the inflation figures, obviously it's going to be a lot more than $2 per hour now in this year of our Lord 2017, supposedly. But yeah, the idea is the nest egg. That's the main idea here behind this particular quote, is you need a nest egg before you can cut loose.
Yeah, and you know, as the next quote will kind of demonstrate, I mean, you know, the first step before you do anything else, before you set up an ethical enclave, before you do X, Y, or Z in the context of Vanu, the first thing you do is you set up, you get your Vanu home base ready to go.
Yep. All right, quote, "Vanu your home first. Domestic activities, sleeping, eating, cleaning, grooming, mending, reading, writing, listening to music, lovemaking, meditating, exercising, conversing, childcare, etc., comprise most of one's life. A Vanu home seems essential for psychological well-being, and domestic activities are relatively easy to Vanu. They do not require elaborate equipment or deep involvement with outsiders," close quote. Sorry, I just thought of something. Remember elsewhere where Shane, where the city psychological pressures that Rayo mentioned about?
Yeah.
So it's almost like the flip side of that is that the Vanu home is your psychological well-being.
So. Yeah. And he says it seems essential. I mean, well, without a Vanu home base, I mean, what do you have? I mean, Without a secured Vanu home base, you'd be living in a tenth floor apartment in Chicago, or I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine Vanu without that Vanu home base. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? If you don't have that one directional isolationism, then you're a part of the servile society. And again, you know, the city's psychological pressures, you know, that obviously wouldn't be good. So I can't see, you know, Vanu working at all without that Vanu home base. There's got to be that separation. There's got to be that, that partition between, you know, the coerced society and then also, you know, kind of the your home base where you're more invulnerable to coercion.
Yeah. And I think we'll need to get into mean time to harassment to some degree. We'll probably do that a little bit later this episode. But I think it's kind of interesting, like what counts as a Vanu home, because like A-level NTH or whatever. That's basically being homeless, quite literally. So, I guess there's that. So I guess this would be more a C level and up, pretty much, and whatnot. So anyway, quote, "An optimally liberated lifestyle must involve a sort of one-directional isolation. The liberator maintains his access to their open but not free trading centers while denying them access to his home. This requires a skillful blend of concealment and deception, plus perhaps elements of mobility and deterrence. A free man obtains information, techniques, key equipment, and supplies out of the servile society, exporting labor or products in return. And during import-export activities, he practices deception, perhaps carries a driver's license, genuine or faked, perhaps pays some sales taxes he cannot conveniently avoid. But the free man's home base is physically concealed. There he spends most of his time. There he may sleep, imbibe, love, design, build trade with fellow freemen, and raise children in relative safety from the savages of state. A freeman's home must be a figurative castle," close quote. Well, I mean, yeah, there was also the old English common law adage about a man's home is his castle. So I guess that would be the one directional isolation is the man's home is his castle. You know, whereas the man's home is his castle is more of a legal interstice, to be fair.
Right. No, I am. Yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, I 100% agree with them. As I just said, you know, I don't see how, you know, Vanu can be a thing without a Vanu home base. I just don't see it being possible at all. But yeah, physically concealed. I mean, that's why, you know, mobility is absolutely, you know, that's why he saw, you know, mobility as being absolutely crucial. You know, hiding your van, you know, deep in the woods, or, you know, having a polyethylene A tent way out there, having a shoe swap dwelling. You know, kind of, you know, I guess halfway underground, or, you know, just completely underground structure, that, you know, I think, like, I multiple sources, you know, kind of, you know, confirmed that, you know, Rayo's, you know, Rayo kind of ended out on, you know, underground dwellings, or at least that was his last known, dwelling. So yeah, physically concealed, you know, absolutely important. And I remember it was, I think it was from Vanu Life, March 1973. It might have been the 16 Ways to Live Free, A Critical Evaluation, the one that was mirrored and also put out on this podcast feed. But so yeah, he also mentioned something along the lines of, you can find kind of these shelters that are built on like public lands, you know, out in the middle of national parks, but they weren't made for Vanu. You'll walk up on them and you'll notice them immediately, or you notice them from a distance. So yeah, obviously that concealment is absolutely important. When it comes to a Vanu home base, because again, you know, going off of meantime harassment here, you're trying not to be discovered. That's kind of the entire goal.
Right. And so I would agree with Rayo that if you have a Vanu shelter, your MTH goes up. However, I would also say that if we're talking like, you know, A-level Vanu or B-level Vanu, I should have said this earlier. Yeah, folks, for more information on mean time to harassment, also known as MTH, please refer to our season one episode on mean time to harassment. But yeah, Shane, I mean, honestly, like A-level and B-level Vanu, there's no shelters with either of those. The shelters really start at C-level, really, like the van nomadism and the minimalist sailboating. And that's kind of the baseline for the Vanu shelters.
Right. I mean, the only possible way I could see for, you know, kind of the A-level and B-level, C-level would be like van dwelling or van nomadism. The only sort of shelters I could see, you know, I guess, you know, coming about would be like, you know, kind of those, like you just kind of lay some trees up against each other and like sleep underneath it. Like they'd be just really low, you know, activity sorts of things. So there might be, you know, some sort of shelter, but it would obviously be, would not be high activity. Like you're not going to dig a big hole to live in. No. You're just going to kind of maybe lay some sticks over and sleep underneath it. It's kind of the idea there.
I mean, maybe, I mean, I'm going to speculate a little bit here before we keep going on with another quote here. Maybe something like a backpacking tent might be B-level Vanu, maybe. But remember, like, tents are flimsy. So it's great for mobility, I suppose, but come on. I mean, if you were physically attacked, you pretty much just need a knife. You know, stick the thing in, rip. I mean, that's what the cops did in, I think it was like 2 years ago in some of those cities where there were like homeless people camped out, and there was actually footage by local mainstream media capturing it. That's all the cops say. They just took knives and just shredded the tents. Okay? So, right.
Such
I mean,
a dick move. God.
Yeah, I know. But hey, that's
like that'd be the equivalent of like I'm in my house. It'd be the equivalent to, you know, just, you know, the state agents like just dropping a napalm on it or something. Like, I don't know. Like, it would, its use value would be deteriorated. I mean, you can't sleep in a tent that's, you know, has no sides on it. It's not a tent right at that point. Right. God, that's such a dick move.
Well, yeah, but that's how the okay. But to go on a philosophical rant just for a moment here, that's basically the state. It basically destroys the products that were developed by the free market. Okay, so when you see cops take the knives and ripping the homeless people's tents, that's, you know, the sorry folks, the system is not broken. The minarchists were actually wrong about something. The system is not broken. The system is working exactly as it was intended to. And maybe some of the founding fathers were a little naive in thinking that, well, maybe if we do things a little bit differently this time in an historical sense, maybe it'll turn out with a different result. But we don't know that for certain. We'll just call it the great experiment in limited government and see how it goes. Again, discussion for another time as far as, you know, the limited government thing goes. But it's just but this is the reality of it. You know, the cops take knives and just rip open the tents. And so the value of tents as a Vanu shelter in terms of B-level Vanu is really, really in terms of mobility and, of course, very, very low activity, right? I mean, Boy Scouts can set up tents, you know, like that. I mean, we're talking, what, 5-10 minutes, no longer? And that's if you're going a little bit slower. I mean, depending on the complexity. I mean, like, if it's like a two-person tent takes up a little longer to set up than just a one-person bivvy, okay? Not to get too technical. You know, one-person bivvies are essentially like a sleeve for a sleeping bag with a little headroom. You know, it's not a lot of space. It's actually barely a shelter at that point. But yeah, man, it's just the Vanu shelters, the typical ones we're thinking of are really sea level that are, you know, a van, a sailboat, you know, something like that where it's mobile. Yeah, but let's keep on going here. So, quote, the liberated home free man, unlike the conventionally living libertarian, can segregate import-export from the rest of his life, essential for development of durable, growing, joyous, free mini-cultures, close quote.
He put that a lot better than I did a moment ago.
yeah. And really, I mean, the durable, growing, joyous, free mini-cultures, I mean, that's... I mean, those are your autonomous zones, whether temporary or permanent. I mean, that's what some people would call the second realm as well. I mean, whatever label you want to put on it, we're basically using different terms to describe more or less kind of the same type of thing. I mean, the agora, as the agorist would put it, think about it, durable, growing, joyous, free mini cultures. That's the agora too. So whatever label we're putting on it, we're kind of trying to describe a different way of being that has nothing to do and is separate from white market jobs and the income tax and the imperialistic wars of aggression and the police state and, you know, fill in, you know, your own grievances here. You know, some sort, you know, where people can actually genuinely be free.
Yeah. No, I certainly agree, because, I mean, how can you, you know, especially with, the second realm. I think the second realm is better than the saying. Is it who was it? You know, build the new society within the shell of the old.
Yeah, those are the syndicalists.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, I think that's I like the saying, but I think the way that the Rayo puts it is a lot better, because if you try to create that new society within the shell of the old, inside of the old society, you're going to be beaten down. It's going to be a lot harder, right? So I think having that separation is absolutely crucial, because if you're getting beat down all the time, your people are getting tossed in prison. It's going to be disheartening, and it's going to, you know, set back, you know, that invulnerability to coercion in that Vani mini culture. you know, that's going to set it back. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely crucial that these things kind of remain separate.
Yeah, one more comment I'll make here before going to the next quote. You know, I know some of the ANCAPs and voluntarists for a while had the silly, more politically crusading debates on the borders debates, even though there's no border because they're not even addressing the real issues there, like the Texan ranchers and such, whose private property abuts the Rio Grande and so forth. You know, I was just thinking, like, if they wanted a real debate on border issues, or at least more strategic thinking, why aren't they talking about, you know, more of this kind of stuff that we are about, you know, like, were the syndicalists right about building, you know, a new society from within the shell of the old? Or, you know, is it worth building, you know, the infrastructure for a second realm where there are real private property borders? Or, you know, or versions on a theme thereof. I mean, heck, if there is going to be the beginning of a second realm, the beginning of the second realm would have to start with Vanu shelters, with people's homes. At least I think so.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. You know, I think Rhea was certainly correct. And, you know, the Vanu home base is the first step. That's the foundational kind of, that's kind of the foundational material. It's kind of a joke. Like, if you're coming to, you know, anarcho-capitalism, I mean, you've read Mises, then you read Rothbard. You might read some Konkin, although Konkin's not very favored within ANCAP circles now, it seems. But there's kind of that building blocks. And you get into the more of the, you know, once you kind of sift through that material, you might jump back to Etienne de la Boetie. You might do some Gustave de Molinari, et cetera, but the point is, you know, Vanu home bases are, like, that foundational thing. I mean, I just can't see it. You know, that invulnerability to coercion progressing without having that secured Vanu home base. I just don't see it.
Right, and even with, like, higher level MTH, whether I might be getting this slightly out of order, but whether it's the D level, E level, F level, Vanu, and the increased MTH thereof, where at that point you're kind of getting along the lines of having something resembling an alternate economy, a real agora. Well, it's like, okay, it would be nice to get to that point. But again, if you can't, I know I've said this many times before, folks, but if you can't walk in a straight line, why should I expect you to run a marathon? So in a similar way, yeah, we should have an agora. We should have a second realm. We should have our own private property borders and so forth. But in order to have a functional marketplace invulnerable to coercion by the state, maybe, just maybe, we should, like, you know, take baby steps and have Vanu shelters first, and then
because. Yeah, because if you can't you know, secure a Vanu home base, then, you know, I'm not gonna trust your capabilities to you know, secure a you know, some sort of a massive operation such as what was it called in Alongside Night, Aurora. Like, if you can't you know, secure your Vanu home base, I'm not gonna trust you to set up Aurora. Just not gonna happen.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's before getting into, like, the really risky, like, or the, excuse me, the more riskier stuff, like the ethical enclaves, at least to some extent. Of course, the water version of it and the minimalist sailboating, that's kind of its own separate thing, right? But if we're doing the ethical enclaves on land, then yeah, it's kind of like you have to do one foot in front of the other. And, you know, if you're not going to, if you're not even going to set up a Vanu shelter, then why should I expect an alternate economy or an agora of anything real, right? And then, of course, not to go too long about this, but, like, I've noticed, Shane, maybe you have too, that some of the rhetoric by some of our friendly and not so friendly competitors has now shifted towards, like, private cities and such. A lot of the agoras now are kind of doing that. And it's like, okay, well, again, earlier this season, we've explained kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly of free ports, free isles, and private cities, and so forth. And it's like, okay, so they're looking at that, which I guess might be better than the old-fashioned political crusading, but then it's like, okay, but then why are they not talking about Vanu shelters? Or even a second realm more generally, you see? I very much think there's a sequence of events here that they're completely ignoring.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think they've they haven't you know, thought about how to change that allodial title to
The fee simple land to allodial title.
Yeah.
Yeah, They're not. I mean, basically, you know, okay, before I get into the next one, I will make one more comment. You know what it's like, what some of our competitors are doing, Shane, in the alternative media? It's like what they're doing is that they want to jump to, like, let's say, H-level Vanu or thereabouts, essentially more or less something along the lines of either a hidden factory or actually more accurately a submarine, like we've talked about before. It's like they want to jump ahead to that, but then they don't want to bother with, you know, a van or a sailboat or some of the stuff that's actually like much more easily achievable, right? It's like they want to jump ahead to the really sophisticated.
They want to
really
jump
nice
toward
stuff.
They just want to jump to the free society is what they want to do, and it doesn't work out like that, guys. It just doesn't.
No.
There's no possible way that it's going to work out like that. It's just going to, you know, turn out to be a lot of, you know, wasted time, money, and effort. And then, you know, I mean, during that time, you could have, you know, had a Vanu home base. You could have, you know, had your sailboat, whatever you decide to do. I mean, you could have already been working towards that. It's very much, you know, like when you're, you know, teaching yourself something, you can't start, like, if you're teaching yourself math, you start at, like, you know, pre-algebra. You don't start at, mathematics for engineering. You just don't do that. You've got to kind of work your way up, and that's kind of the same thing here.
Yeah, and as much as I kind of hate to say this, I personally think that the off-grid homesteaders and some of the preppers and survivalists too are actually much closer to the ANCAP, whatever the heck, quasi-utopia thing than many of, I would even say, even some of the agorists pushing for private cities, honestly, because the one is like this theoretical fluff, which if certain practical things were in place would be much more practical, as opposed to the off-grid homesteaders who some of their homesteads could be Vanu shelters actually, like today, arguably, because they've set up like security perimeters and such that actually blend into the environment, actually do keep predators and cops and whatever else out. So, you know, that's kind of very interesting, isn't it? When different people trying different things, and then some of them, let's say, having the courage of their convictions versus some who don't. And it's very interesting to see what the results have been, at least thus far. So yeah, it's just because people,
and not to mention as well. So say it, something does come into fruition, like you know what they're looking for. Like we'll use Libertopia. Is it Libertopia or why can't I remember?
Liberland.
Like,
oh
so,
yeah.
So they had their you know private city or their new libertarian nation, and because you know they started with that, they didn't you know work up to the other portions of it. Now you know they have it, but it's not working. Like there's a lot of obstacles that have to be overcome. And, you know, they're doing it with, you know, limited infrastructure, limited money. I mean, and without even, you know, clear property, you know, ownership there. I mean, it's very, very distorted. So even if something like that does come into fruition, you know, if they, you know, jump through the first five or six steps and, you know, they get their private city. Well, you know, have you, you know, focused on defense? Have you learned? Has your competency increased with the activity that you're pursuing? I don't think so. And I think it'll be a short lived, much like with the case studies in libertarian nations. They jump straight to that. And I think that's a major factor why those failed. I really do.
Yeah. So whether there's many of our listeners, whether they consider themselves agorists, whether they consider themselves Vanuans, as I'm trying to do, or something, let's say compatibly friendly. The point is, I think a lot of us collect, you know, not to invoke collective movementism though. I think a lot of us really need to have a lot more humility about what's possible today and what's also likely to develop in the future within certain different time spans, right? 10 years versus 20 years versus 30 years, based on certain assumptions. So in other words, yeah, I mean, Shane, I don't know about you, but I can totally see people developing Vanu shelters that are very mobile within 5 years. If people, you know, listen to these episodes, read the materials and actually act in our lives, I totally see this as like the 5-year non-centralized plan. Literally.
Well, you know, I have five plan, like, you know, like especially for kind of like, you know, A through C level Vanu, or
yeah.
even some A through D, you know, kind of like the, you know, like the tiny, like a tiny house, you know, permanent
yeah.
autonomous zone. I could
yeah.
even see, you know, just a couple of years, you know, that could come into fruition, depending upon how committed somebody was to bringing it into existence.
we'll speak about the tiny home thing for a second. That's already caught on. I mean, that's a big thing, like how van dwelling is right now. And that's a good thing. So actually, the time span actually could be a lot shorter, maybe even 2 years. Well, with the main distinction being, okay, so people are familiar with the tiny houses as well as the people who are van dwelling. Some people try to do both, which is interesting. And that's an interesting avenue that's maybe more appropriate for season three in terms of combining different things. But yeah, I mean, think about it. So if they just had better security, if they also did it in such a way to in the context of like one directional isolationism and so forth, I think they could be a lot freer than they already are, you know, like that. So that's kind of something I don't think a lot of people have considered, that maybe there is actually a philosophical component to some of these practical methods, and that there's also a lot of practical methods and you know, and let me put it this way. There's philosophy and then there's practicality. One, if things are going to be consistent, things have to be in one as in the other and vice versa. You know, function, yeah. As Rayo himself said, function determines form, means determine ends. You know, how you go about achieving something is just as important as what that particular end happens to be. And so regarding the Vanu shelters, yeah, maybe some of our, you know, friendly and not so friendly competitors in the alternative media really need to dial down the rhetoric on private cities and dial up the rhetoric on, I would say, a combination of some of our like latest episodes, like on the van nomads and the minimalist sailboating, the Vanu shelters, like this episode and such. So sorry, I didn't mean to go off on that tangent too much, but I think it is related to the Vanu shelters because this is the place to start, I think, in terms of, you know, get your home and hearth, you know, get your own households in order. You know, stop trying to change the world. You've heard that rhetoric over the years, right, Shane? You know, we have to change the world.
Yeah, changing society into, you know, this proprietarian anarchist. That's why collective movementism fails. It's trying to change, like it's trying to change everyone else. When, you know, I mean, yeah, we are fallible. Like we are, like okay. Let me just put it this way: I'm a fallible human being, right. And therefore, why the hell is anyone going to listen to me when I told them this is the way they should live their life? You know, I'd rather live by example and then just you know, have them come afterwards. But yeah, changing society as a whole, yeah, that doesn't work. That doesn't work.
No. And as a friendly, maybe not counterpoint, but parallel to that, remember also what Konkin mentioned in New Libertarian Manifesto, where you have different people offering different strategies and they compete in the marketplace offering, you know, strategy A, strategy B, strategy C. And then people kind of make choices about which particular, you know, methods and strategies work for them and so forth. And so podcasts like these and so forth, we're just presenting different options that I believe are philosophically consistent. At least I would like to think so, but ultimately that's going to be up to the listener to make their own value judgments as far as that goes. But yeah, regarding the Vanu shelters, yeah, I mean, they got to have better security than just these, some of these. I mean, Shane, sorry, one more tangent. Some structures I've noticed that are usually like white market approved in the Servile Society that meet all the building codes and all that. I'm sorry, dude. Why do people think regulations work? I mean, some of these structures, even right here in Austin, are so friggin' flimsy. I even joked with somebody who she admits she's a socialist along the lines of like a Bernie Sanders type. And even as a socialist, she admits that she lives in basically like a twig house, essentially, that like if it rains a little too much, her roof leaks kind of thing. So it's like I'm not really understanding why people are getting excited about this kind of thing or make assumptions that regulations solve anything. The fact of the matter is that her roof is leaking.
Well, Kyle, it's the 21st century, and people shouldn't be living in fucking squalor. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, that's kind of the yeah, that's kind of the attitude, the general attitude. And actually, there was a listener today, July 25th, actually tagged me in an article, and it was this lady who was, you know, talking about her van nomadism experiences. It's not what she called it. She called it van dwelling, I think. But anyways, the article was pretty much, I mean, she talked about why she got into it and. And that sort of thing. But most of the article was literally just about that. It just consisted of, you know, like I had a note put on my van telling me to get out. You know, I didn't. And the next morning I woke up with my tires flat and my, you know, window shattered.
What?
And like, she was just being like, she was harassed constantly. And she had, you know, obviously the cops calling on her and just all sorts of stuff like that. So, I mean, yeah, that's, Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's either, you know, I think you mentioned in that Van Nomadism episode, it might just be, you know, kind of jealousy, like, oh, this person isn't tied to a rent like I am. They aren't paying property taxes. Or there's also just kind of the counterpoint or option is that, you know, it's quite possible, and actually in some instances it definitely is this, but you know, people have this sort of perception of what 21st century, you know, America should look like. And living in squalor in a van is not that. So it's kind of the perception of the state of servile society, too. Even the slaves don't want their, you know, their fellow man to be free. They just can't have it. If they can't be free, then they don't want anyone to be free.
Right. And, you know, and sorry, two things real quickly. One, I think it's rather fascinating that, yeah, the general perception about the servile society, and definitely here in Austin, I can say double and triple this, is that everybody deserves to live in a big McMansion. And actually, they've been building developments not too far from where I'm at, which if we increase property values, at least to some degree, but more importantly, increase the property taxes. And even the county government where I'm at is they've been mentioning I've got a friend who actually keeps an eye on more of the local government shit. In more in the context of like trying to see if anything bad is coming down the pike. And yeah, property taxes are going to go up next year noticeably because of the developments. And of course, those developers, and I did get this confirmed last week from my contact. Apparently, those developers, they're getting subsidies from the county government. So that's a little there's some fascism right there. Again, no federal government involved at all that I know for certain. But what is provable is that the county government basically gave subsidies to this development corporation. So even the leftists should agree with me on this. So these corporate developers got subsidies from the county government in order to build these developments. And then, of course, in return, the property values go up, the property taxes go up. And of course, who gets the property tax? Well, the county government. Yeah, you see how that works. So that's kind of so fascism is still very much alive and well, but of course the conservatives will call it free market, but then again, they don't understand how free markets work. Different discussion for another time, just figured I'd mention it in passing. So in terms of where you set up your VANU shelter, yeah, you may not necessarily want to tie it to private land for reasons that we've gone into a little bit here, but also in that previous episode earlier this season on private land and whatever that topic was for that same episode as well.
Yeah, and I guess one other thing, and it's going to be kind of reinforcing what you just said. Yeah, as far as where you decide to put your VANU home base or to, you know, set one up or, you know, the multiple locations to set it up. You know, I mentioned this in my VANU presentation, or at least maybe I can't remember what I actually said in the actual presentation and what was in practice. But I think I said something along the lines of, you know, it's obviously Rayo did what he did, you know, with his VANU home bases. But as far as, and we still have to develop VANU in cities, but, you know, I really think, you know, that the most efficacious strategies, you know, for, you know, setting up a VANU home base are mobile, obviously the van and the sailboat, I think are two, you know, very, very good possibilities. But, you know, I just don't see. I don't know. We'll have to develop VANU in cities, but where you decide to do this is very, very important. If you're in a city, you're gonna have to deal with more shit than you would have to if you're in a rural area. Maybe, debatably, right? Depending upon you know, all other things being equal.
Yeah.
So that is definitely huge. Just as you would do for. And hell, you might have to strategically relocate to, you know, get your VANU shelter set up. So, I mean, maybe kind of the same considerations that would go into play for that. Only in addition, maybe look at, you know, obviously like the deception, you know, kind of the concealment and all that stuff that goes into it. Because, yeah, where you decide to set up that VANU home base is absolutely crucial. Because if it doesn't make you more invulnerable to coercion, then it's not a VANU home base. It's something else.
Right. And sorry, one other thing I wanted to add before we get on the next quote regarding the lady you just mentioned with her tires getting slashed and her windows getting broken. You know, in terms of improving security on vans, I mean, maybe there's an avenue for maybe having slash proof tires and or having some like security film or like safety film. Like put on the windows. So even when they like next time or for just somebody else, they attack somebody, the damage can at least be minimized. So at least the car is still functional and it doesn't look like it just got raided, you know, broken glass and slashed tires. Yeah. Just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue on here. So I believe it was earlier this season two of ours, we discussed secured communicators, and I think it was the episode on crypto anarchism more specifically.
Correct, yeah, and I think it might have come up in ethical enclaves too. But yeah, the most recent one was certainly the marriage of crypto anarchism, the marriage of security culture and Banu, yeah.
Right. And there's a relevant quote here regarding the Vanu shelters, but in the context of the secured communicators, of course. Quote, "And most of those who lack Vanu shelter will be sufficiently intimidated to abstain from using gold or secure communicators. So Vanu shelter is a crucial prerequisite for substantial Vanu trade." Close quote. Now, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because that kind of reinforces some stuff we've already mentioned, at least to some degree, right? That it's kind of like the old notion about like emergent technologies pre-existing technologies enable emergent technologies, right? So, stuff of think about computers and the internet. Right. That form of technology actually enables other forms of technology that weren't previously available. And so it's kind of something roughly similar here. When you have a Vanu shelter, it can actually enable the development of a so-called alternate economy or, dare I say, Shane, the actual agora.
Right. You know right. What? Yeah.
Yeah. An unregulated, unlicensed, untaxed, non-taxed, laissez-faire, freed market. I think the Vanu shelter would be the crucial prerequisite for an agora, quite frankly. So for those of you who are agorists, is it agorists or agorists? I don't know. I've heard both.
I agorists. That's what Sam said in that debate. So, yeah.
Okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah, agorist, agorism, okay. Yeah.
So for the agorists, if you guys really want to develop the agora, you know, because you guys are trying to starve the state and then smash it later, kudos to you guys. I'm just simply suggesting, kind of as, you know, the friendly over here, that maybe you guys should focus your efforts more on developing Vanu shelters than promoting private cities. You know, just saying. Because the Vanu shelter is the crucial prerequisite for, I think, an agora.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. You know, I think agorism is great, obviously, you know, even if it's just for, you know, kind of that financial independence avenue. I think it's great for that reason, but, I think there's, you know, I think, you know, as I said in that article and as we kind of talked about, you know, I think, agorism and Vanu, you know, complement each other very, very nicely. For those who, if you're an agorist and you're still listening to this, if this is your first time listening, I mean, listen to the entire, you know, series. I'd highly recommend it. But I really do think, you know, if the focus shifted rather than from, or I guess, nowadays, it seems like most folks practice agorism because it improves their situation. You know, if they don't pay taxes, you know, that gives them more money to spend.
Yeah, child necessity and all that, yeah.
So, I think the focus is less on, you know, smashing the state now. I think that was obviously the goal. But I think if that goal is going to be achieved, it's going to take, getting those Vanu shelters, you know, put up where you're as invulnerable to coercion as you possibly can be. And then, you know, building that Vanu mini culture. And then having a bunch of those Vanu mini cultures, and then to the point where it kind of takes over society, which is not going to happen, I don't think. But I think there's a better strategy there, and I think Vanu, incorporating that into agorism might be a wise thing to do. But then again, it's already implemented, right? It's ethical enclaves.
Yes, and so for folks who want to learn more about agorism and more kind of the relationship between Vanu and agorism, please listen to our previous season 2 episode on ethical enclaves for all the 20 million different details and how all that goes together. But in context of the Vanu shelters, I would really say, yeah, if you want to have an ethical enclave, if you want to go be an agorist and actually help set up the agora, or some version thereof, or an element thereof, or dare shall I say an industry thereof, but I mean industry in a good way, like a particular field, then yeah, I would suggest that the Vanu shelter is kind of the place to start. And that goes, and by the way, that goes double and triple if you're going to go the black market route. Like, gray market is one thing, but if you're going to go black market, I would say the Vanu shelter is actually going to be more important than not, because you're automatically now at, or arguably you're automatically at more risk if you go black market versus gray market. Of course, there are people, there are agorists who do both gray and black markets just because it's more profitable for them. But again, in the interest of keeping people out of prison, yeah, the Vanu shelter is, I think that's just good security culture, quite frankly.
Right. No, I certainly agree.
All right. And for our next quote, shelter development is still our biggest activity. Our situation the past year, Vanu, comfort, convenience, winter, we can have any three of the four, but not all four at once. I.e., we can live in Vanu and comfort with convenience, but not in winter. We can be comfortable and Vanu during winter if we forego convenience to do many things, etc. Close quote. So I think, Shane, that particular quote by Rayo came from, I think it was Report on Progress and Problems, wasn't it?
Correct. And yeah, and what he's talking about here is there's one, I guess it probably was that same chapter, if I remember correctly, but he talked about how when it was extremely cold out, you know, pretty much all him and Roberta and Naomi, or Halen, you know, just choose your name this week, they pretty much just stayed in the foam hut all day and they couldn't really do anything. So for going convenience to actually, you know, whether it be, you know, writing a new article on the typewriter, or whether it's, you know, get going and gathering wood for, you know, maybe their wood burning stove or whatever it is, a lot of that stuff was just kind of put on hold, because, once they left that foam hut, it was game over there, in the winter in Siskiyou.
Right. So I think something to be kind of taken away here, and the reason we're not going to go into the 20 million different technical details on the different structures, is that it's pretty much it was a lot. And Shane, correct me on this. I think Rayo was giving very detailed details, things like, you know, so many, you know, cut this length to so many yards. It was like almost like reading an instruction manual, wasn't it?
Yeah, it'd be yeah. So we decided not to read that entire chapter here. It'd be very, very dry. I don't think it'd be very entertaining for a podcast. But you know what I will say is, if you are considering Wilderness Vanu, or, you know, even Van Nomadism, I mean, I still think that's kind of valuable, because it's gonna be relatable. Because I remember one of the articles on Van Nomadism, the guy said, you know, in winter, you know, it's still hard to stay warm. So you might be able to glean some input from that. But yeah, it's very, very dry material. And yeah, it's pretty much how to. It's not as technical as the articles in this new Vanu Life edition, but they are still pretty technical, and it's dry. And yeah, if you're pursuing that portion of Vanu, then yeah, I definitely recommend it. But for those interested in other things, yeah, maybe, you know, as far as, you know, kind of what Rayo, you know, looked into, or I guess what he wrote about, what he's, I guess his report on progress might be beneficial to you. Still recommend you read it, but yeah, it'd be too dry and not very entertaining for a podcast.
Let me just provide a counterpoint before going on to the next quote, which is simply this. If you listeners give us enough, give us enough proof of market demand and you demand it, what I would suggest is, if there is enough market demand for it, maybe we could make a mini series as part of season 3, where literally each one of those different structures that Rayo was experimenting with, like the polyethylene A tent, the foam hut, maybe that ply new thing, whatever those underground structures were, I guess like makeshift bunkers, I suppose, and whatever the versions are of, like each one of those could be a different episode in a mini series as part of season 3, where we could go through the technical details, but only if you listeners really want us to. So again,
yeah,
I
actually thought about this, you know, when I was actually transcribing some of it today. You know, I actually considered, I mean, the materials aren't expensive. I've probably got, you know, many of them down there at the ground already. You know, I might actually, you know, for season 3, you know, once I could justify it, you know, like once the costs are covered, because, you know, I got my own stuff to pay for, guys. I'm sorry. Yeah. If the costs are covered and there's demand for it, you know, I will actually, you know, do like a video tutorial. You know, because we've got the guides now, the how-tos, exactly like the tutorials on how to do it. So, you know, we could actually see what, you know, Rayo's structure kind of looked like. That one, there's also the shoe swap, I think he called it, the pluma or whatever it was called. But yeah, there are a couple structures you talked about, and I think it'd be fun to actually, you know, build one of those things. So yeah, for season 3, I mean, I wouldn't be adverse to doing that at all. I'd get down to the ground and, you know, I'd have a reason to go down there again, right? And you actually just build those structures. So I think that'd be a lot of fun if there's demand for it. So yeah, let us know.
Yeah, then, and I'm really pleased to hear that potential offer, Shane, on the video tutorials, because that would be something very visual that people could see that, hey, this isn't just like abstract stuff we're talking about here. There actually is a practical application as well. So yeah, folks, my email is Kyle@VanuPodcast.com, or for Shane, Shane@VanuPodcast.com. Let us know, email us, let us know if you want detailed, really detailed, like almost instructional material, kind of stuff. Maybe not as boring as an instruction booklet. We'll try to make it, enjoyable and such, but still pretty detailed on whether it's the polyethylene A-tent, the foam hut, some of the other structures Shane just mentioned. Let us know. And if there's enough demand, then yeah, we'll do some season 3 episodes on this. And it'll probably have to be a mini series because they are kind of interrelated to some degree, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But as far as this particular episode goes, this is just more about Vanu shelters in general. So yes, we will not be going into, for example, like how many, like, I will say this, just give it a flavor. Like at one point, Rayo mentions about like 4x6x2 feet versus 4.5x9x2 feet when discussing something. Okay, we're not getting into any of that stuff this episode. But if you want us to, ladies and gentlemen, email us and maybe we'll do some season 3 episodes on that. So yeah, just making the offer.
Yeah, since obviously we rely upon market feedback. So you are the masters of this podcast. Obviously, the ultimate decision making will come down to us, but we obviously want to hear from you. And if that's something you want to hear, if that's what you want to see or hear, certainly more than happy. I don't care what about Vanu it is. I'm happy to talk about any of it. So
right, but just. It's a lot of detail for each one of those type of Vanu shelters, never mind all of them that Rayo mentioned. So that's the only reason we're kind of skipping over the technical details for those different structures in this particular season 2 episode about Vanu shelters. It's just because it's a combination of too much detail, plus it gets very, very technical and dry, just like Shane said. So if you folks do want us to get into the dry technical stuff, it would have to be for season 3, and you would have to email us and let us know whether yay or nay, okay? So this one, for once, guys, this is on you listeners, whether this is going to happen or not. So for season 3, so I'll just leave it there, okay? Now, continuing on. Rayo also said, quote, general thought on shelter, build small shelters and have several in an area far enough apart so that discovery of one is not likely to lead to discovery of others. Use soft foot gear such as moccasins lined with foam. Actually, that's a good idea for travel between them and to water sources and latrines to minimize disturbance of ground. Good conservation and Vanu. Use hard foot gear like regular boots only when hiking outside of home area. Advantages of multiple small shelters, many more suitable sites, easier to put under / between trees and bushes with little cutting, not as visible, small structure with few possessions appears less, quote, permanent if discovered, less likely to arouse curiosity or hostility. Disadvantages, travel between them, items not always at hand when wanted, quote. Okay, Shane, I like that quote for so many reasons. So how about you take a first swing at it, and then I'll hop on it.
Sure. So I'm actually catching up on The Walking Dead, the TV show. I like watching the survival ones, even if they're unrealistic as all hell. But I was watching it. Now, anytime I watch anything, it's from the eyes of, like, it's kind of, in the context of modern, because it's always on my mind. But what I recommend for the listeners, like any of those sort of survival shows, like The Walking Dead or Jericho or something like that, just, watch those and just kind of, try to think through the eyes of Rayo. Like, what would he see? Because I remember there was one instance, and this relates perfectly to this. I don't remember what his name is. I don't remember. He was walking and he hopped on a horse, and I immediately thought, I was like, damn, but he better hope he's not getting tracked. And sure enough, the next cutscene, there's a guy looking down at the track, just following him. It's like, okay, well, I wouldn't have noticed that before. So that observation is extremely, extremely important. Using soft foot gear when you're in the home camp area, and then when you're outside of the home camp area, it doesn't really matter as much. But a mistake like that could get you found out. So to be conscious of that, I think is extremely, extremely important, because the point is, there's an article in Vanu Life March 1973, and It's Ecology Vanu. It's a picture. It's not actually a title, but it's like ecology to Vanu, technology to Vanu, technology to ecology, Vanu to peace, and then Vanu to ecology. And as a Vanuan, I mean, you know, whether it's out of kind of that environmental aspect, or just out of the, we don't want anyone to know that we were here. You want to leave the land as unaltered as possible. So I think that's a very good observation that he had. As far as increasing that MTH.
Yeah. And sorry, I know we've mentioned this earlier this episode and on previous episodes. I'm going to mention it again because it's directly related to this particular quote. When it comes to mean time to harassment, there's a reason why it's best to start with A-level Vanu and then develop your skills from there. One of the things you learn when you're doing B-level Vanu, basically essentially being a backpacker, is that you learn very quickly about what, interestingly enough, the Boy Scouts of America would call like leave no trace, where essentially you're very sensitive about... back during my Boy Scout days, we all wore boots, usually lightweight hiking boots. And we're very sensitive about leaving, an impact on the ground because Gaia or whatever. But the point was, like, for example, if we're walking on structures where – or not structures, excuse me. If we're walking on types of materials and surfaces, excuse me. If we're walking on types of surfaces – that we don't really change just by putting our boots on it, then that's very different from surfaces where we do leave boot prints. And of course, part of leave no traces don't leave the boot prints and so forth. So for example, walking on rocks, walking on well-beaten paths, walking on really basically those kind of hard surfaces where you're not going to leave a boot print. Is a good thing, and generally speaking, you try to stay away from like mud, where you do leave boot prints. You don't try to walk on types of surfaces that would increase like soil erosion, especially like in or near trails, like hiking trails, and there's all sorts of other types of surfaces where basically you're disturbing the local ecology. Some of the eco-fascists and lefty types would say things like, we need to leave the pristine wilderness pristine because, man is like a virus on the earth or whatever, because basically they're closeted eugenicists. Discussion for another time. But suffice it to say, I do partially agree, at least in the context of if you actually use a boot to place your weight on those types of surfaces, you will leave a mark. And that's true. You do. Now, whether that's good or bad is a completely – that's a value judgment, right? But it's still a fact that on some of those types of surfaces that are more pliable, you do leave a mark. I mean, what? The average adult weighs, what, 140, 50 pounds or more?
Thereabouts, so, something somewhere in that range.
Yeah, some people have said it's, the average American's 200 pounds, yuck, 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 right? Maybe making a reference to the alleged obesity epidemic, which, of course, is only possible because of the corn subsidies, but that's a discussion for...
Self-inflicted.
yeah, it is, which is caused in large part by the corn subsidies. But again, that, too, is a discussion for another time, because that's getting into more why the system is, why the way it is, and why we're trying to get away from it, at least with our one-directional isolationism and whatever else. So regarding the tracking issue, yeah, I mean, a lot of things can leave tracks in soil or whatever your surfaces are. So whether it's a boot print, like shoe print, whether it's a you were mentioning the example of like the horse hooves, mm-hmm. or the horseshoes or whatever. Actually, tire treads too. Tire tread. I mean, you park a van like in mud and then you roll away, assuming you don't get it stuck in a sinkhole, right? That's actually happened to some people. You're leaving tire treads behind, or the imprint of it in the mud, especially if
and that's why Rayo, they park the van far away from where they're camping.
Yeah.
Not
well,
even
actually,
close.
Yeah. And there that's very wise to do. And sorry, one thing I just thought of. If you like park in mud, or you even travel through mud, and then if the weather changes not long after, and so you go from kind of this kind of wet,
cemented mushy, in there, yeah, Your tread is there. Yeah.
Right. And so in that dried mud, that's like the natural version of like using like a, okay, this is getting a little technical, but like a plaster of Paris, like what the CSI like forensics guys type guys do. The real ones, not the stupid TV show crap, which basically is bad sci-fi. But like what the actual like forensics guys do, where they use plaster of Paris to basically take an imprint, an artificial imprint of like a suspect's a shoe print. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, this stuff is real, okay? So in terms of not accidentally leaving a trace behind, so to speak, then, yeah, just be sensitive about the types of services you're traveling on, whether by foot, horse, or car, or whatever else that would potentially leave behind a trail. So what Rayo was saying here in this quote was more about feet, right? Use the soft foot gear such as the moccasins and like on certain types of surfaces or whatever, and especially like in camp was the context here, right? As opposed to the what do you call the hard foot gear when you're, you know, as you said, hiking outside the home area or the regular boots. Yeah, there, and see, that's interesting too, because if you're like in camp, so again, let's assume B level Vanu here in terms of MTH. If you're in camp, then yeah, I mean, heck, it's actually normal backpacking practice, Shane, that after you've been like hiking the day in your boots, that you take off your boots and you wear your secondary pair of foot gear, whatever that is. Rayo here says moccasins, but there's some people use sandals. There is also a kind of a more obscure type of footwear not a lot of people really recognize, but something called like aqua shoes, where essentially it's like a piece of like rubber and then like some like not fishnets, but like some type of like spandex type material on it that you could technically like use while swimming. Hence the term aqua shoes. Get it? Mm-hmm. So you can walk in it to some degree, but there's like no arch support or whatever. I don't want to get too technical, but that would count too as soft foot gears, whether it's like an aqua shoe type thing, a moccasin, sandals, and I want to be absolutely clear in this, not flip flops. Please, for goodness sakes, flip flops need to like really go away. I'm still surprised there's people who have a market demand for flip flop. No, seriously, like one of my relatives was running in flip-flops one time. She tripped, and this was on a sidewalk, and maybe this wasn't exactly the smartest thing she ever did, to be perfectly fair, but she like tripped on her flip-flops and she chipped a tooth on the sidewalk.
That's crazy. Yeah, I wear flip-flops. I wear sandals all the time, man. In the summer.
Yeah.
All the time. Forget putting on socks. I'll just, you know, toss on some flip-flops. I'm going somewhere.
That is at the
place I work now, you know, reduced hours obviously, which is fun. But yeah, they don't allow flip flops because you know, people twist their ankles and stuff, and that's bad for, you know, company insurance. That's a very good observation. I wanted to mention this too, before I forgot it. But you know, furthermore, beyond just you know, what you wear, it's also, you know, how you walk, right? And this is also from the Walking Dead. And this is only a couple few hours ago, but it was actually Carol, the old lady. And there's this new guy out there training, and she was like, oh yeah, and by the way, heel toe out here in the woods. I could hear you coming from a mile away, like that sort of thing. And also when you're building the shelter. Now when we cut logs down in Southern Illinois, we'll cut some big ones. They'll make a loud noise when it hits the ground. Probably not advisable. Since you're trying to keep your noise level down, to the environment level, and Rayo talked about that. But yeah, when you're building your shelter, I think he mentioned he only uses dead trees or ones that are so grouped up that there's like, you know, five or six trees in like a small group, and one of them's gonna die eventually. He might cut out that center one or something. But obviously if you're dragging back sticks or something, you probably wouldn't want to drag it back to camp. That wouldn't be smart. But then also just kind of the noise level that you're operating at whenever you're building that shelter. So just a quick note there.
Yeah, I think those are definitely things to keep in mind. And one more thing I'll say about this quote before we continue on. Notice how Rayo at one point mentioned about advantages of multiple small shelters. I know, I love that so much that he was even considering that, well, maybe when it comes to Vanu shelters, maybe we should also consider the fact that maybe it's not so much the singular. Maybe what's more important is the plural, as in Vanu shelters, as opposed to a Vanu shelter. And I think the difference is rather quite important in that, well, maybe you should have like more than one.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah, I think that's wise.
If
you have one, you only have one option, right? And it's always good to have options. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you're pulling back to one and you see, you know, Bludge over there, you can always just you know track back and go to the other one. You're fine. So it's always nice to have options.
Right. Well, kind of like how I mentioned in some of our, you know, most recent season two episodes, like whether it was the minimalist sailboating, the van nomadism and so forth, and even just other episodes where we've mentioned just kind of in passing things like the tiny house people or other types of things people are experimenting with, even right now, is that, well, why do you have to have only one like home that's mobile or whatever? I mean, why can't you have a tiny house and a van? And a sailboat, you see, and have like different combinations of things too. I think I've brought that up before, and I would say the same thing here in terms of Vanu shelters. Like again, if you've been pursuing financial independence already, and you can obviously afford these things, being responsible in that sense, not doing what some people have done and go into debt or get. I think somebody even tried to get mortgage on a tiny house one time, which even the tiny house people didn't like that at all. Yeah. That actually discussion for another time, but
that might be worse than the credit card preppers because at that point, like you're stuck there. Like you've got a mortgage
defeating
on
the
this.
Purpose of,
yeah, you've got a mortgage on this. Like, oh my God, save up for like 6 months or a year and then do it.
Yeah.
I mean, like it's a small house. It's not going to cost that much.
No, it's not. But see, yeah, that's kind of the purpose of the thing. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So actually, who knows? Maybe that should be a season three episode where people are like doing like the bastardized version of some of the stuff we're talking about. And whether it's the credit card prepping.
Titled What Not to Do.
What? Maybe that should be a season three episode, folks. Again, let us know. Kyle at vanupodcast.com. Shane at vanupodcast.com. Let us know if we should do a season three episode on like the bastardized versions of some of the stuff we're talking about, whether the credit card prepping, getting a mortgage for a tiny house, like the complete wrong ways of doing some of this kind of stuff. Because I've been noticing it too. It's just kind of like, wow, really? But hey, you know, people who still need to exorcise the collectivist spooks from their heads will find all sorts of ingenious ways to try to marry some of the stuff we're talking about with of course, the servile society and of course, the state, you know, more specifically, right? Like, how can you possibly screw up this otherwise good thing that's going on? It's kind of like Bitcoin, right? Like, how can you screw up Bitcoin? Well, you have the lobbyists go in and basically try to make deals with the federal government, right?
How can you screw it? It's which way do you want to screw it up, unfortunately?
Yeah, so maybe we will do an episode on season three. Like, let us know, folks. But again, discussion for another time as far as that goes. But yeah, regarding the Vanu shelters, though, I mean, why not have a network even of different shelters that actually, Shane, do you remember? I think we mentioned this back in season one. Do you remember what Rayo said? I know I'm going off the cuff here about like the fleeing libertarian revolutionist.
Yeah.
And that Rayo wouldn't be adverse to like basically essentially running an underground railroad of sorts as to shelter.
Yeah, he might even be able to put his skills to better use, too. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. Well, at least that first part about like the Underground Railroad part, like, well, if you have a network of Vanu shelters, well, yeah, that's basically your underground it could be converted even temporarily as uses like as a de facto Underground Railroad or whatever. And of course,
that's brilliant, dude. That's honestly brilliant, too. Like if you consider. I don't know, we'll just use, you know, Siskiyou region for example here, but say there's, 15 or 20 of them set up out there and, someone gets in trouble and, they contact, you know, the Vanu Association, they're like, hey man, I need a place to hide out. It's like, all right, go to, you know, latitude this and longitude that, so you'll find a safe house there. There's enough food there to last you a couple of months. And yeah, like that'd be huge. They're going to look for him in the woods either. So, I mean, there's the wilderness version of this too, or it can be, obviously it doesn't have to be that, but you know, that's a pretty brilliant idea. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And oh, by the way, one other thing while I'm thinking about before we go on to the next quote, you know, if the agorists were smart, and I assume some of them are, because they've done a lot of good things. as long as I've known like their history, and also some particular individuals who shall go unnamed. You know, if the Agorists are smart, what they would do is they would see this as a profit making opportunity. And there's kind of your ethical enclave angle in terms of like, well, yeah, pay us to basically smuggle you out, especially the more high value the fugitive is by the state in terms of how many resources they're going to commit to actually like doing the manhunt, the more potential profit it goes in actually running them out of the country or wherever. So there's a couple different ways one could kind of play with this. But even if it's not something exciting like a fugitive like manhunt type thing, even in terms of normal day in and day out life in a more, shall I say, preventative sense and all that, I think that's where the Vanu shelters really kind of are its most value, because at that point you can have your ethical enclaves and not get into a situation, assuming everybody's got good security culture and so forth, not get into a situation that later, much, much later down the road, because somebody has now been targeted by the state and so forth, would have to become a fugitive, and therefore, you know, then the Agorists have to smuggle them out of the country or whatever, right? So again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so whether in the context of being a preventative, which is where the Vanu shelters really shine, or even as a cure in the sense of being converted to like even a temporary underground railroad type thing. I mean, Vanu shelters are like good all around, regardless of the context. Yep. Is pretty much what I'm saying here.
You can't go wrong with the Vanu shelter.
You can't go wrong. And sorry, one other thing while I think about it, you know, if the Agorists were also additionally smart, even outside the context of Vanu shelters, if they can figure a way how to make profit based off of other people's unfortunate circumstances, and a lot of times brought on by the state, I think even they would be a lot closer to developing the Agora, and yes, even to the point of smashing the state, even if they could like again, whether it's the context of a manhunt fugitive type thing or even other things even I honestly can't conceive of, if the Agorists say, hey, how can I make money at, you know, doing X that runs counter to what the state's trying to do, then yeah. So yeah, I mean, like developing crypto note or those kind of things, or any one of a thousand different types of entrepreneurial and even black market, I would even say just good old fashioned black market opportunities, not just gray market. Yeah, if the Agorists were smart, they would do that. So, but yes, in the context of this episode on Vanu shelters, yeah, it would be the Underground Railroad type thing, and it would also have to be different types of structures, because obviously the state agents basically trying to, let's say the FBI, hypothetically, they would basically be I know how the profilers think, basically. They're saying like, oh, if somebody's being run out and we're trying to chase them down and they're getting help and assistance, or you're aiding and abetting a fugitive is what they say in terms of legalese. What they try to actually look for, and yeah, I'll mention this publicly because I want to keep people out of prison who don't deserve to be in prison because of victimless crimes and such. What the actual profilers and what they kind of look for is that they're looking for like the same types of structures. So if you're running somebody like between a set of apartments, they're going to be obviously going to be raiding and kicking down the doors of people in apartments. Or if it's McMansions, they'll do it with the McMansions. Or you see they're looking for it's essentially pattern recognition. So if you were smart, what you do is break it up. And you would do all sorts of different types of shelters and structures that I'm not going to get into here publicly, okay? That's actually how you would even have a realistic attempt at actually trying to beat them at their own game, kind of. But of course, again, if an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and we don't have people being actively hunted by the state, then that's actually the best situation, where we can just have our ethical enclaves, we trade with each other, we have our Vanu shelters, and everything's fine, and the FBI is just, I don't know, dealing with the so-called terrorists that don't exist, because they create them. Or shall I say the federal government creates them, but that's a discussion for another time, too, as to why that is.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I wasn't familiar with, I guess, that profiling strategy. But yeah, so I guess what you're saying then is, so you'd have your wilderness location, you'd actually have, like, you know, a McMansion. Then you'd have, you know, a smaller sort of, you know, house, like maybe a tiny house. Like, you'd kind of...
You mix it up.
Okay.
And to be fair, it's not on us to list every single version. The point is mix it up. You need to break up the pattern. And I'm not saying it's a guarantee. And again, my interest in saying this is I don't want innocent people put in prison. Okay.
And don't go to a family member or friend or close friend's house because,
they'll know all that stuff.
You want it to be like that, no tie at all. I would imagine so.
Which
is where I don't have any personal experience with that. But if it's a business and they don't know who the hell they're talking to, if it's through encryption, you know, that would be, best. It's like, hey, like, well, okay, what connections do they have? Well, we don't know a connection they have with the guy they just talked to today. There's no way to track that back. There's no way to, you know, compile that, surveillance data. It'd be very, very difficult.
Yeah, and again, that would be another profit-making opportunity for the agorists. So it's like, yeah, they don't know me from Sam, right? And of course, if they were smart, they would use pseudonyms. They would kind of take some hints from the Second Realmers and a couple other things. Again, discussion for another time. But regarding the Vanu Shelter specifically, here's my point. Here's my bottom line point, especially for the bludgies who may be listening. When it comes to the Vanu Shelters, they can be used for all sorts of purposes. Whether they are acceptable to your own fake laws or not, that's the bottom line. Whether they be considered legal or illegal, they work for all sorts of purposes. And so the only reason I'm mentioning it here is that this is a real thing that people can actually do. It doesn't involve changing your fake laws or voting for your political crusaders and so forth. This is something people can actually do to have a better quality of life. It is a lifestyle change, as is pretty much all of Vanu is, right? Shane, is pretty much lifestyle changes that you can do yourself.
Yeah.
And so the Vanu Shelter is just another part of that. But continuing on here, and definitely for purposes of time, Rayo also said, quote, "My present expectations are that G and I can progress to level D primarily by refining present techniques, living mostly above ground, and importing most supplies. Progressing beyond D will probably require fully underground shelters and new access techniques. I'm more optimistic about this now in March of 1973 than when I wrote this in November of 1972. At midwinter, our Plinu structure was doing well, and I've conceptualized lifestyles which ease interface problems," close quote. So, yeah, notice the level D. That's a reference to Mean Time to Harassment, isn't it, Shane?
Yes. Yes, it definitely is. It definitely is. And with the underground structures, obviously the reason those would be D level is because they're permanent autonomous zones. Sure, you could have multiples of them. But like I said, earlier on, I really do think, the sources are corroborating this, but again, we've had sources corroborate things before, like the name of Rayo's Freemate, and we're still confused. I kind of led to believe that he did go for the underground structures. So I think that's kind of interesting there. So that'd be, progressing beyond deal across fully underground shelters and new access techniques. I'm guessing that have to do with the underground structures. I mean, how do you get into it? How do you deseal the entrance? I don't know. That'd be interesting. And unfortunately, he drew up all sorts of diagrams and tutorials on, the foam hut and the polyethylene A tent. And he did talk a little bit. Let me back up here. And how to build and design with natural timbers. He did kind of talk about, a little bit about how to build that underground structure. That's interesting. That's interesting. And the Plinu structure would be more of kind of a, I think it'd be more like in between, like some of it's underground, some of it's not. If I remember correctly, because he compared that to the Shuswap dwelling, which the bottom portion is, in the ground, so you kind of use some of that the heat of the earth, which helps with winter. Then you obviously toss the foam hut in there. But I think that's more of a combination, the Plinu is, rather than just the polyethylene A tent, which is all above ground, honestly. So very interesting points there. And I like when he points out the Mean Time to Harassment, the MTH level. In his articles, it actually gives you an idea, and I like that he carried that through all the way, from the 60s, till 11 months before he, disappeared.
Yeah, because he was serious about actually measuring the efficacy of Vanu, as we explained in much more detail in the MTH episode back in season one, right? And so it's kind of all that all over again. So yes, in the context of Vanu shelters, I think pretty much we're starting from C-level Vanu and then going to D-level Vanu and then up from there, right? So we're, like mobility of the shelters and then which are temporary autonomous zones and then going from there to like a more permanent autonomous zone or closer to that, like a private city once you get up to Private City was like FH or I, or it was really high up there, whatever the MTH level was. But yeah, obviously to keep things realistic to what's achievable, at least for now, in terms of Anu shelters. I mean, we're really talking about C&D for now.
Yes, yes. And see with Rayo, and this is exactly, and then, like, we're talking about Rayo here. Like, for those of you who've been listening to this podcast, have read his book, and for those of you who've read his book, I've been, you know, posting about it. I've seen in the past week people who have just recently gotten on board. I scroll through Fascist book, and I'll see, like, the first line of a sentence, and I'm like, that's a quote from Rayo, and I'll expand it, and it's like, hell yeah, they're posting quotes from his book. So for those of you who, you know, have listened to the podcast, read his book, you understand that Rayo was a very unique individual. He was a very unique individual. He was, you know, pretty advanced, you know, with his engineering capabilities. But he still, you know, he walked before he ran a marathon. You know, he's that overused, you know, kind of cliche example again. He started with, you know, he started with the van nomadism, which, you know, granted, that is, you know, sea level. And then he kind of worked back, you know, kind of in between B level and C level, where he did have that polyethylene A tent. And then he moved into, you know, so he went from, you know, kind of the C kind of, you know, to BC sort of level. And then he worked up to like a D with underground structure. So even Rayo, you know, he worked on this, you know, increased his competency. And, you know, what was working towards, or, you know, again, you know, from the sources, he worked up to that D level Vanu. So I think that's worth pointing out.
Yeah, so again, there's a genuine sense of humility here that I think Rayo was very good at kind of demonstrating by example. And I would kind of suggest to people listening to this that you ought to seriously kind of do the same thing too. And again, there's nothing wrong about talking about free aisles, free ports, and private cities. Heck, you know, please see our earlier episode this very season about that, those related topics. But at the same time, in terms of the liberty in our lifetime, to borrow a slogan from a certain organization I don't particularly care for, in terms of our liberty in our lifetime, maybe the next generation, maybe. I mean, how quickly – here's an interesting question for you listeners to kind of think about as we are, you know, transition to our conclusionary points here. But think about this. How quickly – are humans in general willing to exorcise the collectivist spooks from their own individual heads? How quickly are we talking here, just in terms of speed? Yes, even in an evolutionary, social evolutionary sense even, how quickly are they going to choose individually to exorcise the collectivist spooks from their heads?
Well, quickly, I'm thinking you more like, well, if.
Okay, well then, and so the private city thing is like, that's interesting, and yeah, it's part of the libertarian history, so it would be kind of disingenuous to some degree to completely ignore it. But we've addressed it here. We've addressed it. It's part of the history. And now that we've addressed it in this season, it's kind of like, okay, let's get to the more practical stuff. Come on. You know, like, does anybody really want to strategically relocate to South America? Like, really? Come on. No. So at least not me. So, but like, strategic relocation is a real thing, and van nomadism is a real thing, and the minimalist sailboating is a real thing, et cetera, right? So that's kind of something to really kind of take away in terms of Rayo getting to, you know, D-level Vanu, is that, you know, he put one foot in front of the other and, you know, kept keeping on keeping on. And he had successes, unlike political crusaders who have no successes, or even worse, grow the power of the state. Rayo, by contrast, actually developed something through his forms of direct action, which did make him more invulnerable to coercion, didn't he?
Yeah, that's certainly accurate. That's certainly accurate. And I want to reemphasize this point again, you know, on the subject of, you know, Vanu shelters or Vanu home bases. I love the fact that, you know, Rayo emphasized so heavily. And this is, you know, just from his book, Vanu, the Search for Personal Freedom. He emphasized so heavily that, you know, this is the first step. This is the very first step, because if you don't have that place where you're most invulnerable to coercion, you know, that being the Vanu shelter, the Vanu home base, then I mean, I think he was kind of thinking the same thing. What the hell are you doing? I mean, if you're going to be, you know, semi vulnerable at all times, then you're not, you know, then you're not a Vanuan. The goal is to become, you know, more invulnerable to coercion, not, you know, start off, you know, in a, I guess, maybe a paradoxical sort of situation, like, well, I'm not invulnerable to coercion, I'm not vulnerable to coercion, I'm both at the same time, and I'm none at the same time, too. I mean, yeah, I think the Vanish Shelter is certainly, you know, the starting point, because your import-exports, you know, builds off of that, too. And that one directional isolationism. So it's the most it's a place where you're most invulnerable to coercion, and it's a crucial aspect to import export, which again, it's absolutely crucial. You know, import export is you know, the importing of goods and knowledge to your Vanu home base and exporting that labor. That's extremely important.
Yes, and before we get on with the rest of the conclusion, you said something interesting. I just want to kind of pop up because. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there will be a, and this is a little bit of a sneak peek for you guys, there will be an episode later in this season two of ours on Vanu in the cities.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here's an interesting question to kind of ponder before we do that episode. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Can an apartment become a Vanu shelter under certain conditions? That is actually a rather fascinating question because we're debating on whether it's an important issue or not.
Yeah, it's an important question in the development of Vanu, yeah, especially, you know, mm-hmm. Vanu in cities. Yeah, for sure.
And I would kind of suggest that when we do that episode, we'll directly try to answer that question. But between now and then, while you're thinking about Vanu shelters more generally, just ask yourselves this question. Under what circumstances would it be possible, if any, to turn pretty much any apartment into a Vanu shelter? Just something to chew on. Not going to answer it this episode, but we will definitely get into the weeds in at least some degree when we do the episode on Vanu in cities. Just something to chew on. So as we are now into the conclusions, yeah, it would be plural, right? The conclusions. I think something about the Vanu shelters is that this is the type of thing where you're going to be the most invulnerable to coercion, right? So as opposed to like, it's basically like the polar opposite of a traffic stop, right? Where you're like the most vulnerable to coercion, right? Side of the road and all that. Yeah. The Vanu shelters, I mean, this is where I would say aside from pursuing financial independence, I mean, this is pretty much kind of where it's at, you know? This is where you're going to be invested. I mean, like Ray himself said, I mean, we're spending most of our time not even chasing, you know, the so-called money, really the Federal Reserve notes, but we're developing our shelters. This is what we're doing most of the time. And that, I think, is rather quite important. So when it comes to the practicality of Vanu, of actually, shall we say, the practice of Vanu, one of those practices, and maybe even perhaps the most important or really kind of up there, would be developing the Vanu shelters, whatever those happen to be. And this can merge with other things, like, again, like the van nomadism. Well, the van was a type of Vanu shelter. So you kind of have a merging of different things there and so forth. So like the van nomadism wouldn't just be a way of strategically relocating, it would also serve as a Vanu shelter. So as you can kind of see, the practice of Vanu can take different types of methods, techniques, and yes, even concepts, and depending on how you use them, can blend them all together in a way that makes you, well, more invulnerable to coercion than you were before.
Yes, I certainly agree. And actually, it's a conclusion. I'll go ahead and mention it. But, you know, I've been thinking, Kyle, and obviously I'm a sailboat guy, right? I'm kind of known as a sailboat guy. That's how I got the communication specialist position at the Marinia Project. Yes, so apparently it's getting out there. You know, I've actually been thinking, you've done some further thinking on it, and, you know, as far as, you know, getting to where I want to be faster, you know, the van nomadism thing, you know, it doesn't seem to be, it seems to be pretty appealing. You know, as far as especially the cost, I mean, you don't have to spend a whole lot of money to do that. You know, a sailboat can be a little more expensive and all the other factors that go into it that we talked about, you know, such as kind of the major learning curve. You know, I'm semi-considering van nomadism. Anyways, yeah, I mean, just as Vanu shelters, I mean, no matter which one you choose, if it's going to be a van, if it's going to be a sailboat, if it's going to be, You know, a polyethylene A tent, if it's going to be an underground dwelling, a shoe swap dwelling, or whatever. You know, the point is, yeah, it's the place you're going to be most vulnerable to coercion. And I think that's worth reiterating again. You know, being in a 10th floor apartment in Chicago, Chicago, as I like to call it. Yeah, not very, you know, invulnerable to coercion at all. Now, you know, maybe that would be, well, like, maybe we should take a very extreme example when we touch on that Bonnie Wayne Cities episode. Like, could you be in, like, a really bad part of New York City? Or, like, I don't know, some extreme example. We'll postulate that later
on. The slums,
on,
like a yeah, slums or like a ghetto type
something,
thing.
Yeah, something where like, you know, coercion is everywhere. You know, not just from bludgies, but also, you know, private as well.
Public and private.
So is there a way to, I guess, you know, come up with solutions for that? Because I do think, as far as, you know, Vanu, you know, not everyone wants to do wilderness Vanu. Not everyone wants to do van nomadism. Some people, you know, like living in the cities. So I think that strategy is needs to be developed.
Or at the very least, there are people who would like to do those things, but they need something like now, today. Like, they can't wait, like, however much time it would take to develop those other things for themselves. Like, they need to be in vulnerable coercion like today because they're trying not to get, you know, bumped off or whatever. So, I mean, right. Like, again, desperation can also be, well, maybe not desperation, but necessity or I'm trying to think of the right word, but basically the exigencies of the moment can sometimes encourage some forms of innovation under certain circumstances. So again, I don't mean to sound too much like a bureaucrat with all those qualifications, but it's like, yeah, if somebody's interested in Vanu, but they're like too poor and or for now, or they're just surrounded by too much violence around them for now, then yeah, they need some kind of like mitigation type thing. So, you know, to keep themselves at least a little bit safer. At least for now. And I don't think that's unreasonable at all, because I wouldn't be surprised if there was a couple of our listeners who are living in a kind of nasty slum type situation with drive-by shootings and whatever else. And so it's like, hey, you know, maybe certain routes around certain, you know, bad neighborhoods is perfectly the right thing to do. So you can kind of avoid that kind of trouble. And no, it's not racist to say that, because some of the lefties are kind of like, oh, well, you, in order not to be, you know, prejudiced, you have to walk through the dangerous parts of town. And of course, they never walk through those parts of town, despite all their multiculturalism. So it's kind of like, you know, yeah, no. That's just no. A topic for another time, but no. Anyway, other conclusionary points here. Yeah, the Vanu shelters, like was mentioned at the beginning, are really crucial to good import-export. If you think about this, you know, it's one thing to export your labor and products out of the servile society, but then it's like, where is that stuff coming from? And then, of course, in terms of import, that one's kind of even more obvious in some sense, right? Okay, you're importing, you know, goods and knowledge, but then where is that going? Like, where do you store the goods that you get from the servile society? Well, you stored your Vanu shelter, right? So that's kind of rather interesting. So yeah, the Vanu shelters are crucial to import-export, right? You can't really have that one-directional isolation without the Vanu shelter.
Right.
I would also say the following, too. If you're not serious about having a hardened home, really don't even bother pursuing Vanu at all. You know, I would say this. It would seem to be the case that really having one Vanu shelter is like a bare minimum to do this effectively. And obviously, as one of the earlier quotes where Rayo was even addressing having multiple shelters, you know, multiple ones are preferable. But at bare minimum, you got to have one somewhere. You know, I mean, at this point, I mean, Shane, I mean, I'm thinking about this off the fly, but even some of the survivalists have mentioned things like spider holes. You know, in some sense, even a spider hole could be kind of like the really, 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 really poor man's Vanu shelter. I mean, like, literally, it's a hole in the ground that soldiers used, like, when they're to hide from the enemy, especially.
Right. Yeah, and there's actually a survivalist term for, you know, having those multiple Vanu shelters being a network of safe houses, right?
Yeah, or something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, even if you're kind of even if you've just started pursuing financial independence and for now you're a little bit hard up financially in terms of money, I mean, like, how hard is it to construct, or let me put it this way, how expensive is it to construct a spider hole or multiple spider holes? I mean, that's real, even I'll admit, even for me, that's roughing it. But those spider holes have their own applications, right? The point is to, like, hide from the enemy, and then if you need to pop out and, you know, like, pop their skulls out or whatever, then that's that. Of course, that's assuming more of, like, even, like, a war or revolution type situation, or even, like, vigilantism to some degree. Self-defense type situation is what I'm kind of getting at. But even outside the context of what those spider holes were originally designed for, like, if you're really hard up and you need a Vanu shelter, like, if you can learn how to construct a spider hole, and preferably more than one, then that's something to at least get your foot in the door. So not to mix metaphors, right? That's something to kind of get your foot in the door in terms of a Vanu shelter is, you know, consider learning how to build spider holes. And then develop it from there as your finances and, of course, personal interest allow. But yeah, I never wanted anybody to say that, oh, Vanu shelters cost too much. No. Dig a spider hole. Make one. If you're really hard up and you need invulnerability to coercion right now, I would say spider holes are pretty much where it's at. Now, they're not very comfortable and they're dirty. That's true. People with claustrophobia probably would not be very good with it because there's not a lot of space, but it gets the job done and it's cheap. Now, having said that, if you folks, well, I want comfort and I want a little bit of room, even if it's just in the van, well, then it's going to cost some money. And then maybe you guys should, like, you know, be a little bit more frugal with your spending, you know, as was mentioned in the financial independence episode, but I'm just saying.
Yeah. So, for those who are their first time listening to this podcast, you just got recommended to go dig a spider hole. there are a lot of possibilities for Vanu home bases, but yeah, that would obviously be the cheapest one. But yeah, like I said just a moment ago, I mean, the Van Nomads is seeming more attractive because it'll cost less.
Yes.
It'll cost significantly less than would the minimal sailboating. So it doesn't mean that I'll never do the sailboating. I want to. It's my. I guess you could call it my dream. But whatever will make me more invulnerable to coercion. And if that's Van Nomadism, then it's Van Nomadism. So, I guess that's kind of where it's at.
Yeah, exactly. And also keep in mind too, you know, as your finances allow and all that, there's all sorts of products and techniques available that can help increase the security of your homes, whether it's like the safety or security film that you can apply on the windows, whether it's like reinforced walls, like cinder blocks that are reinforced with rebar and concrete. And then, of course, there's various different types of early detection systems, whether they be of a more digital nature where you use a smartphone, or even more old-fashioned early detection systems. I think, Shane, remind me, did Rayo mention something about using aluminum cans, or is that somebody else?
Yeah, so I'm trying to remember exactly what the context was for that. It was either, I don't think it was early detection per se, but it was a defense measure. So what he would do, decent ways away from his camp, he would hang a string with like four aluminum cans on it, so that when the wind blew, those would, you know, cause noise and ruckus. Therefore, you know, someone's going to go in that location rather than his Vanu home base would be deterrence. So that was one thing that he did. I suppose you could have something similar. As far as early detection systems, if you just had if you laid out like a piece of metal like underneath or like, you know, like foot, like let's say Shen level, and you like surround your premises with that, I guess. Your premises, we're not talking philosophy here, premises, and you just like, you know, like you just hang cans on there, and if someone walks through that, you hear the can. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of ways to do that. It doesn't take you don't have to spend, you know, $1,000 on a really high tech security system. I mean, you can use aluminum cans. Like there's old fashioned techniques that Rio used that you could still use today. So yeah, that's certainly an interesting one to bring up.
Yeah, exactly. I think I wrote an article that was about hardening your home, and there's more details about that. It's also in the my last book, Just Below the Surface, A Guide to Security Culture, which includes that article as a chapter. And so, yes, I mean, this is also part of having good security culture is having a hardened home, which is a Vanu shelter is basically a type of hardened home, really, and is really definitely a good way of putting it. At least I think so. So Shane, is there anything else you'd like to mention for this episode on Vanu shelters?
I guess just one thing in regards to your last book, Just Below the Surface, A Guide to Security Culture, that is for sale on Amazon if anyone wants to pick that up. Just search for, you know, Just Below the Surface, or, you know, search for Kyle Reardon or Shane Randall, people to pick it up. But yeah, that one's up there if you guys are interested in checking that out. But other than that, you know, as we've said many times thus far, I mean, you know, Vanu home bases, Vanu shelters are where it's at. It's the starting point. You can't, you know, found any libertarian country before you can secure a Vanu home base. You just can't do it. And, you know, history is, you know, has bore that fact. So, yeah, you know, you're in the Servile Society, you know, you're working towards Vanuans. Well, you know, get that nest egg and start, you know, looking into your Vanu home base. What's it going to be? Is it going to be a van? Is it going to be a sailboat? Are you going to do the polyethylene tents? Are you going to, you know... live in a Shuswap dwelling? Are you going to live in the Plinas that Rayo talked about? I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You've got to figure that out. That's the biggest first step, and probably the most important decision that you'll make, because everything else is, you know, built off of that. So you want to make sure you do that part right.
Alrighty, and that's all we have for you. Make sure to check out the website vanupodcast.com. Please consider leaving us a financial contribution while you're there. So we talked about Vanu home bases this week, and next week we'll fill you in on Rayo's food storage setup. Aw, yeah. So thanks so much, y'all. We'll talk to you next week.